Well, as I said in this first part of the program, our guest is Catherine Pertini. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Currently at the United Nations, she has the post of Undersecretary General for Management and has had that job since the fall of 2002. Before that, however, she served for 10 years as the executive director of the United Nations World Food Program. That's the world's largest international humanitarian agency. She also, before that, had considerable experience in government. She served as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for Food and Consumer Services at the USDA, and also as Acting Assistant Secretary of the Family Support Administration in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And also before that, did spend some time working in government, both in states of Illinois and New York. And among other things, she has been given recognition for her work by the folks who do the World Food Prize. She was the winner of the World Food Prize in the year 2003. She's here visiting the campus, and her visit here is sponsored by the folks in the College of ACES. That's Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. It's part of their Global Connect series. And also she'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series on the subject, Progress Toward Global Food Security. That will be this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And all of these programs, they're always open to the public and free, and anybody who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. And as I said, this was a program that had originally been scheduled for a couple of weeks ago, and our guest had to make some changes in her schedule, and we were actually planning on having her on at that time, and we're pleased that it worked out so that we could have her with us here this morning. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Back in 2000, the member states of the United Nations got together, and they adopted this series of very ambitious development goals, which are called the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. And there are 8 of them, and they deal with a number of areas, including health, things like combating AIDS and other diseases, reducing child mortality, promoting gender equality and empowering of women. And the number one on this list is to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. And the agreement was that they wanted to see significant progress on these goals by 2015. So we're here now, roughly speaking, about five years into this period that we've set out to try and make progress. And you're here to talk about how it is that we have done on this very first one. So I realize this is a very big question, but I'll start there with the most basic question and say, well, how have we done now over these years? What sort of progress have we made toward this first goal?
Well, first of all, to define the goal a little bit, we're talking about people who earn less than a dollar a day, who live on less than a dollar a day, and that's really essentially this definition of poverty. And the agenda is for it to cut in the level in half from 1990 to 2015. If the projected growth remains on track, it looks like within that time frame, the global poverty rates will fall to 12.7%, which is less than half of the 1990 level of 27.9% of people who are living in desperate poverty. And that will mean that there will be at least 363 million more people who will have averted life in extreme poverty. Mm. So if it remains on track, that goal will be met. And that is good news because there's a lot of effort going into that. But the bad news is there's still obviously hundreds of millions of people living in desperate poverty. And that's something that we need to continually address. Yeah.
Well, that's I guess that gets to a very basic point here, that if you look at all of these goals, they, in a sense, they're all connected. And many of them do feed back to this very first one, because poverty seems to be the bottom line issue. And in the job that you had before running the World Food Program, you were involved in a lot of situations where you were providing food in an emergency. But this is something different. I mean, this involves a long-term kind of change, a long-term development project, so that in a sense that people can feed themselves. This is not the kind of thing where the world is going to be able to do this. What you're talking about is empowering the people to do this themselves. Now, this is a much more ambitious and much more complicated project, as difficult as it would be to deal with some of the emergencies that you were involved in.
It's true, but let's talk about those people in desperate poverty for a minute. Mm. First of all, they have, I mean, these are generalizations, but it applies to most of them. If they earn the equivalent of less than a dollar a day, they may never really earn anything. They have to scrounge for food for their families. They may not own any land on which they can grow food. They may not have any animals which can be used for food. There may not be any job opportunities in their communities. So what they're doing is whatever they can to survive. These are women that have one piece of clothing, some sort of a what we would call a decorated sheet kind of thing that they wrap around their bodies. They have sometimes many children, in part because so many of them don't survive, that mm-hmm. they want to be sure to have some children. They're not educated, many of them, and they have very, very limited means to be able to do anything. Now, what happens when a woman in this situation, when a girl in this situation grows up? Well, she has babies, and it becomes a cycle of poverty that just continues generation after generation. You have a baby when you're 16, when you're probably not old enough to have a baby anyway. The baby may or may not survive, but in any case isn't going to be very healthy, doesn't have enough food to eat, therefore it isn't going to grow intellectually or physically as well as he or she could, and therefore when that child is an adult, they can't even absorb enough educationally if they had the opportunity. So it's this kind of desperate poverty that is still the core of the problems worldwide. And you're right, when we get involved in an emergency situation, the biggest one of late, of course, is the tsunami, where the world, fortunately, is reaching out to help these desperate communities. We help people who are living through a disaster, either man-made or natural, but that disaster eventually ends. These people who are living through, the people who are basically poor, are living through a perpetual disaster. And the public doesn't really know about it. We all know about the tsunami, and thank the Lord we're all being generous. But we don't know about these women in India or Bangladesh or different countries in Africa who are so poor that their families could barely survive.
Yeah. Well, this raises an interesting point, I guess, and that is, overall, when you look at the needs of the world, they're considerable. And then you look at how it is we have responded to disasters. A lot of the material that I've read in connection with the response to the tsunami said, well, it's certainly wonderful that the world is responding the way that it is. But there are a couple of problems here. There are concerns about people actually, governments, making commitments and then actually fulfilling them. And there's reason to be concerned because when we look back at past disasters, that is exactly what has happened. There's been something. It's got a lot of attention. There's been an outpouring of sympathy and support. People have promised to provide aid and promised to do rebuilding and reconstruction. And that's good for a little while. The problem is that often promises aren't fulfilled, that work never gets really completed, we go on to the next disaster, and that there are people now, I know there are people around the world who had lived through previous disasters who look around them and say, we have still not recovered, what about us? You know, how do you approach the scope of the need with the resources that the world has, admittedly large, but also finite?
The first need is for the very first immediate response. Remember when Hurricane Mitch hit Central America, for instance, and it rained and rained and rained like it's been doing in California lately, and all of a sudden the hillsides went down, wiped away whole towns and cities and farmlands and everything else. So people immediately needed shelter and they needed food, and from the World Food Program got them food within 48 hours. Other things took longer. But it took years before the fields were all cleaned up, before some of the factories were be able to be functioning again, and certainly in many cases before people had houses rebuilt to be able to live in instead of the temporary housing. Tsunami is this on a huge scale. Now, what happens? At the immediate need, it's in the newspaper, it's on the television, you're talking about it on the radio. and people give, whether it's the United Nations giving and governments giving, or whether it's individuals writing checks to non-governmental organizations. They give. We have in the aid community a bad news day, which is called the day that CNN leaves town. The CNN factor, they call it, but it's not just CNN. It's BBC. It's NPR. It's anybody else who's been covering these things. And then after a while, the editor or whoever says, okay, now move on to someplace else. Because it's not, and it's then after that, it's no longer front page story. And the contributions go way down from that day forward. You can chart it. So it's a direct relationship to what kind of press coverage is being given and how much the contributions continue. And those are new contributions. But then there's the issue that you raised that countries make pledges, you know, grand meetings of great pledges for whatever it is, Iraq, tsunami, Kosovo, and then over time the pledges aren't all met. That is a problem, and I think the answer to that is there needs to be more accountability. There's a lot of talk now about how there needs to be more accountability throughout all the systems, and there's going to be a lot more accountability on how the reporting works for all of the contributions for the tsunami. Well, there also needs to be accountability about pledges made and pledges received and why those pledges aren't made. All of this is to say that the biggest problem is, I mean, beyond the crisis, is that over time, the people who are still living through a crisis because their entire community was ruined are forgotten. Yeah. And they're forgotten just like people we were talking about before are forgotten, who never lived through a big dramatic televised crisis. They lived through a daily crisis. They're not just forgotten. They're never even known about.
Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is Catherine Bertini. She is the Undersecretary General for Management at the United Nations and has had that job since the fall of 2002. Before that, she served for 10 years as the Executive Director of the UN World Food Program. She also was the winner in 2003 of the World Food Prize. She is here visiting the campus to talk about the progress that we have made toward global food security. Her talk is this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus, so people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana are certainly welcome to attend. Also here on this program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I took you down a little side street here. We'll come back to the topic of meeting the Millennium Development Goals, and this one in particular. You talked about one thing as a contributing factor or something we might want to work on, which of course is a controversial subject, maybe family planning. But that's not the only thing. I guess I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about what sort of concrete steps do you see us needing to make, again, to deal with this one big issue, poverty and hunger?
I have a very strong opinion on this matter, that there are many things that can be done, but the one single most important thing that could be done in order to decrease poverty is to be sure that all girls are educated at least through primary school. Right now, there's a great disparity in terms of the number of boys who have education, the number of girls in many countries. Not all boys are in school either. So essentially universal childhood primary school education is critical. And why is that true? Well, first of all, in the countries where girls are educated, their gross national products are higher than the countries where they're not, across the board. Mm-hmm. Number two, if you look at issues in agriculture, and of course we're here today to talk a lot about agriculture, so many of the farmers in the world are women. In Africa, 9 out of 10 of the farmers in Africa are women. Yet studies show, including a group called International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, that their study and others show that women farmers look to other women farmers as role models in order to improve their own production. And the better educated farmers are, the more opportunities they have to improve their own production. So, in other words, poor women, uneducated women, follow educated women farmers, and educated women farmers produce more. When women are educated, they know more. They can read and write. They know more. They know more about taking opportunities that come to them in their village. They know how to count. They know how to read. If they are educated, they have less children than the women who are uneducated. The average is twice. An uneducated mother has twice as many children as a woman who has had at least primary school education. And that's basically because a woman learns about child spacing, and she learns about, what kind of capacity she needs to have in order to raise these children. A woman who's educated also knows more about the health care needs and the nutritional needs of their children, of her children. Even for those societies where they believe that boys are prominent and critically important, that boy grows up spending his days with his mother. So even in that kind of society, why wouldn't you want your child to be spending his time with an educated adult? Because then that child is going to be better off in the future.
Well, I think it's a point that other people have made that women are a very underappreciated, undervalued development tool in a sense, and that also they make the same connection you do. We see this connection between a voluntarily limiting family size and education. But it sounds as if you still have a problem sometimes in some places making that sale, persuading people that they are undervaluing their girls and the women in their society.
Well, there's no like one big sales force going out trying to convince, ministries and ministers and others that this is a good thing. It's got to be a grassroots effort in large part. But it also, yes, certainly could be something that's promoted by the top level people in governments. And again, based on some of the commitments of the Millennium Development Goals. So it can be done. But by the way, it's pretty inexpensive relative to the amount of money that could be spent on aid. If you take all the estimates together of what the World Bank and UNICEF, UNESCO and others estimate it would cost for universal childhood education, it would cost about $1 billion a year over 12 to 15 years. That's, $1 billion is a lot of money, but in the context of priorities, It's relatively small, mm-hmm. and the impact it could have is very large. I encourage every and non-governmental organization possible, every individual donor, and every government possible to put this as a high priority. In fact, when I won the World Food Prize, it came with a $250,000 award, which I dedicated to the cause of girls' education, and the World Food Program matched the amount, and we've raised some other funds since and put it in a trust fund to use to give to small local NGOs who are working to get more girls in school.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me again, you come up with a number of what it would cost to do it. How does that compare with actually how much money we're spending on that line item in our big development budget?
Well, I don't think I'm not sure I know any organization that says this is how much we're spending on girls' education or on universal education. So I think it's
no way to know.
I think it's hard to do. Maybe someone does. I don't know.
Yeah. Questions, of course, are welcome here in this part of Focus 580. We're getting very close to the midpoint. Our guest, once again, Catherine Bertini. She is Undersecretary General for Management at the UN. And was for 10 years before taking on her current job, the executive director of the UN World Food Program. She's here visiting the campus to talk about the progress that has been made toward the global food security, which is one of the UN Millennium Development Goals. That's a series of goals that were taken on by the nations of the world, the members of the United Nations, back in 2000 and said that by the year 2015, they wanted to make significant progress towards these goals, eradicating poverty and hunger, achieving universal primary education, promoting gender equality, and empowering women and others. There are eight of them altogether. Our guest is here to give a talk on the campus. She'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. This is an event in the Millercom series, and also is her visit here sponsored by the College of ACES. That's Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Someone listening this morning in Charleston, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Yes. This may be a moot observation by now, but from the middle 18th century till today, the movement of Western Europeans around the world and the ensuing chaos and ruination of indigenous cultures and the subsistence paradigm by which they lived, which has been totally and utterly, almost destroyed. And organizations like the UN or the League of Nations or these Band-Aid on a bullet hole approaches, and I understand that the efforts to do something about it is a human quality, and I don't discount that. But why isn't it that the upper classes that are interested in the welfare of indigenous peoples and their cultures do not take a more militant stand and demand in the world body of the UN and the upcoming International Criminal Court and bring these invaders to the bench and pursue and to try to alleviate the problems where, and I've mentioned this before, that there is a child dying every 3 seconds. And indigenous cultures did not, that never happened. They took care of their own. Of course, they died of other causes, some starvation and hard times, and those sorts of events over which they had no control. And, of course, when they rubbed on one another and the tribes got too close, I mean, and the scuttle for food was upon them, then those are natural reactions. But the outside influence of mainly Western Europeans and upon the third and fourth world, and it continues to this day. And I'm wondering what if there's anything in the agenda of these international organizations that's going to approach and articulate those problems that are created by the West. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, you respond in whatever way you like.
Okay, well, first of all, I think that this whole idea of the Millennium Development Goals, which were agreed to by all the leaders of all the countries in the world who met in 2000 in New York at the UN, is a huge step away from what you suggest. Perhaps used to be, or you suggest maybe still is in part the case, all of these countries have said, we are going to make our own commitment toward reaching these objectives, and we are going to make our own commitment to these actual goals that were put in place. And this wasn't led by or directed by Europe or North America. It was really a consensus document. So it's really everyone taking responsibility for their own situations and moving forward. And then, of course, some of the wealthier countries hopefully making commitments to give where is appropriate. Now, on the issue of Band-Aids, when I first went to the World Food Program and we were defining our mission, because there hadn't been a mission defined, we decided that a definition of our mission was to end hunger. And a couple of people said to us, what do you mean end hunger? You can't end hunger all by yourselves. And we said, no, we can't. If one organization could end hunger all by itself, it would have been ended centuries ago. We can do our part to end hunger. But unless we have that as a goal, you know, we really don't want to help alleviate hunger or help make hunger not so much of a problem. We want to end hunger. So our approach is small, even though we're the largest humanitarian organization now in the world. But it's in addition to the approach of Catholic Relief Services and CARE and hundreds of thousands of NGOs and UNICEF and others. And all together, we're helping people in local communities make a difference in their own lives. And that, I think, goes a very long way.
Well, I hear what the caller is saying, and there may indeed be people who would agree with him, who would say something like, well, really the only way that we're going to achieve justice in the world and take care of the problem of poverty and the needs of the people around the world is with the radical restructuring of the world's political and economic systems. Okay. I guess for someone like you who is in a position that you are, when someone says something like that to you, is your impulse to say, well, that's swell, but that's never going to happen, so let's get real? Or how do you approach a kind of critique like that?
Yeah, the way you just described it, which is to say, well, that's a nice thing, go write a book about it, but it's not going to be actuality what happens on the ground. What happens on the ground is that we have to work for better governance and more ownership, less corruption, more commitment to actually improving the lives of people in any given community. That's what has to happen on the ground.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the last caller. We got some others. Let's go to line number one. This is someone listening in Urbana. Hello.
Line number one?
Yes.
Yes. I was wondering about the role of agricultural subsidies given in the United States as well as European countries and the adverse impact those subsidies are having on food production in many countries. One of the examples that probably happened inadvertently was in 1965, as a result of a war between India and Pakistan, the United States hanged an embargo on food delivery to India. India was totally dependent on food supplies. As a result of this embargo, for the first time, India picked up the challenge, and the Green Revolution that they call now is a substantially a part of that challenge. Today, a lot of the countries in Africa are having a problem where their own agricultural produce is sitting in the sheds where American supplies are being distributed freely, bought here at home at taxpayer expenses, and the subsidies seem to be working counterproductively. If we don't deal with these things, then any help that we're trying to give to these people is no more than Band-Aids. We need to work some systematic changes and cannot afford to tell people, go write a book about it. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah. Comments?
Well, I think writing a book was referring not to agriculture, but to a total redoing of the political order of the world. There are several points that the caller made that are very important. One is the Green Revolution in India really changed not only India, but the way a lot of people look at the ability of developing countries to be able to feed themselves. One of the things the World Food Prize does, for instance, is to reward people who are working to do just that. And as was Norman Borlaug when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. For instance, this year there was a rice scientist from Sierra Leone and another from China who won the prize for their work in creating a new hybrid rice that could grow in a much larger volume and could ward off weeds and could do better even with less water. So they were really growing rice that could have a multiple effect and feed many more people. And so there, that's obviously not the only example. There are many examples of people trying in a small way to replicate what India did in a very large way, and I think that's very good. As far as the subsidies are U.S. And Europe, one of the great hopes around the world is for the WTO upcoming, the next round of talks, to be able to deal better with these issues of the subsidies, which certainly take care of the farmers in North America and Europe, but cause all sorts of competitive disadvantages for the farmers in the developing world. And that must be one of high priority for attention. The free food distribution that I think the caller referred to, there is free food distribution, but there, I think it's important to point out that there are two different kinds of aid with food. One kind is targeted food aid. That's the aid that goes to the tsunami victims or goes to specific programs in countries around the world where there's a specifically designated problem and shortfall. And a lot of care is taken to be sure that the food that goes in for those purposes is not food that's already being grown in the country and that that food does not compete with the markets in the country. Also, there's a lot of care that goes into purchasing food in developing countries. I know from the World Food Program perspective, it alone is the largest purchaser of food in developing countries because it purchases food with cash and then distributes it to countries in nearby countries. So I think that is helpful, too. But the other kind of food aid that is problematic and that could be what the caller is referring to is called the technical word for it is program food aid. And that's where one country, whether it's the U.S. or some other country, actually part of the foreign aid that it gives to a country is food. And it'll make some arrangement on the diplomatic level. We'll give you X millions of dollars of cash and X millions of dollars of wheat or corn or something. And then they just bring that food by ship and offload it at the main harbor in the recipient country, and then that country does with it whatever it wants. This, I believe, it greatly undermines the systems in the developing countries, and it is something that has been cut way back, but it still exists, and I believe it's quite problematic. So, no, there's no need to write a book on this topic. I think there's need for action.
Right, let's talk with someone else. I have a caller in Gibson City, line number two.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I guess my concern is the military aid we give to countries, and I'm going to talk what I know about. I know Colombia and Israel-Palestine. I know I haven't been to Colombia, but I have people that have been there, and they tell our people that tell your government not to give military aid to our government. We need other kinds of aid. Same with Israel-Palestine. Palestine, you know, don't give Israel military aid because it's you know, they're doing things to the people on the West Bank, like demolishing homes and the dividing wall. I don't, you know, I was really shocked. I went over there and saw the dividing wall, and the dividing wall is first of all, it was supposed to stay on the green line, and it doesn't. And what it does is cut people off from their commerce, and it cuts people off from their food. And even before the wall, they were cutting people off. If you look at the map of how things are done in the West Bank and Gaza, they're like living on Bantustans. And you know, what do we do about that as a country? And as you know, could the UN help in kind of letting the U.S. know that, you know, military aid is not the right way to deal with things? I mean, like I said, the two areas I know of is Colombia are somewhat educated about, and I thought, you know, how do we educate people or get them to tell our government this is not the right way to go about doing things, that everybody deserves to, you know, eat and drink clean, clear water? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope, first of all, that the caller has written her views to Senator Durkin and Obama and her congressman. Second, and to the White House, for that matter. Second, the issues about the West Bank and Gaza, I spent some time there on behalf of the Secretary General a couple of years ago, looking at the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the West Bank. Prime Minister Sharon had said at one point, well, all right, send in someone to look at these things. So I was the person that was sent, and I ended up having long meetings with then the late Yasser Arafat and members of his cabinet, and with the Prime Minister Sharon and members of his cabinet, and not in the same rooms, I might add, but in trying to come up with recommendations for alleviating some of the humanitarian strife that many of the Palestinians were living under. And as a result, there were a series of commitments that the Israelis made that they would put in place. However, this was before the wall. The wall at the time was being talked about, but it was pre-wall. I have a great hope that that there's now so much energy and commitment directed toward improvements in the Middle East and seemingly goodwill on both sides from the leadership of the Israelis and the Palestinians, that we may now see real movement. And so I'm going to be optimistic.
Yeah. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Catherine Bertini, winner of the 2003 World Food Prize. She served for 10 years as the executive director of the UN World Food Program and currently is the Undersecretary General for Management at the United Nations. She's here visiting. I'm going to give a talk later today about progress toward global food security. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I wonder if I might ask you something a little bit different about the United Nations. A couple of years ago, the Secretary General appointed a task force, a committee, to consider the question of restructuring of the United Nations. And last fall, there was a report that was put out, and it contained a very long list of recommendations, I think more than 100. The ones that got the most attention in the press from the stories that I read had to do with the restructuring of the Security Council and the question of should it be larger, should there be more permanent members, how do you do that? But there was a lot – there were many other things on this list, and I guess I'm interested in perhaps hearing you talk a little bit about this project of thinking about restructuring the UN and of this big package of recommendations of those things that nobody – probably paid attention to, or very few people paid attention to. What in there do you think was really important?
Yes, the Secretary General appointed a 16-member panel of prominent people. Brent Scowcroft was the American on the panel, former prime ministers, other prominent people who had worked a lot in international organizations and international diplomacy and management. And that group came up with a whole series of recommendations, as you said. Yes, and the one that got the most play is the Security Council future. That seems to be difficult to try to sort its way through on its merits, because certainly the people who are already on it, the countries who are already on it, don't want to make any changes. And, of course, the permanent members being the U.S., the U.K., France, Russia, Russian Federation, and China. But others are saying that reflects the post-World War II political reality, not today's political reality. And when you think about it, when the UN was first founded post-World War II, there were 51 members. Now there's 191 members. So that in and of itself is a huge difference. So there'll be a lot of discussion over the Security Council thing. And it's fascinating to watch it. I don't want country X to be on it unless I'm on it, or if I can't be on it, I don't want country Y to be on it. Or we should have somebody from our region, but it shouldn't be this guy. It should be this guy. I mean, it's a long thing. It's all human nature. It'll be interesting to watch. But yes, many of the more important things we're talking about overall, the UN's role in terms of peace and security, the functions that are appropriate for countries to undertake in terms of defending themselves versus preemptive wars or strikes, the involvement of the UN in peace and security over the long term, the involvement of the UN in development and things we started talking about at the beginning of this program and how it works to alleviate poverty. Is it organized the right way in order to do that? Does it have the right kind of staff? Should we be considering changes in the staff in order to achieve these objectives? And it was a really very thoughtful report. And I think part of the assumption, again, is that this organization, not just the governance, but the organization was built after the war and through the early 50s. And now we're still functioning. And we add things, But we really don't subtract things. We really don't look and make sure that we still have the right priorities and the right functionaries in order to meet those priorities, both in terms of systems and people.
Do you see anything in the offing, do you think, that's really very dramatic in terms of restructuring? As we said, the Security Council thing, that's very important, and that's maybe there's no surprise that that's the thing that got the most attention. But there was so much else.
It's a little bit early to say, because what happens now is the following. The panel put out its report. The Secretary General is due to put out a report in the next couple of months. That's his focus on not only these proposals but others. And in the meantime, there are all sorts of informal meetings going on between the representatives of member states discussing what they like and what they don't like. And the idea is that there would be a resolution of these things in September at the 60th anniversary meeting of the UN, which would be attended by, I'm sure, more than 100. The expectation is more than 100 member state heads of state. And that would be the culmination. So at this point, it's very hard to predict where that might go.
Yeah. As of late, the United Nations has been coming under a good deal of criticism, and so has the Secretary General. Now, you have to say that there's nothing really new about that. Over time, there have been a lot of times when people have been critical of the United Nations for various sorts of reasons. And the United States, from time to time, has been very critical of the United Nations as well. But I think that there are some people who say that there's something different about the point where we are now, and have really said that they think that there is a crisis. The United Nations is in crisis, and the future of the organization, probably going too far to say the future is in doubt, but there are questions about it and its continued health and whether or not it will continue to be able to do what we hope that it can do. Do you think there's anything close to the truth there? Is the United Nations in a time of crisis now?
Oh, there's no question. It's a very difficult time for the UN. And the panel, the 16-member panel, was in part a response to the UN crisis over the decision about the war in Iraq and the fact that the Security Council did not decide to proceed with the war and the U.S. government and its allies did. So that was in large part a genesis of the decision by the Secretary General to say, well, we have to relook at what our role is. And so that, I mean, on a political basis, that's a major review that I said will culminate in September, and it's difficult to predict right now exactly what will happen. On the management side, the Food for Oil investigation is significant, particularly in the U.S., where there's a high level of interest in it, in that. But again, the Secretary General said early on, well, I think this needs an outside investigation. He picked Paul Volcker and two people from other countries who are all above reproach in terms of their own public reputation to be able to look into this. And they're very diligently looking into it. They've put out an interim report. I'm sure they'll have multiple reports after that, and so hopefully the UN can get over that issue. But in the process, all of this has raised issues about accountability and issues about how the UN does approach the resolution of problems. At the same time, the world has seen the UN's response to the tsunami, where there isn't another entity in the world, nor could there be one invented, that could have the breadth and the scope to be able to supervise a large-scale disaster operation. And the UN, it's one of the great strengths of the UN that it could do it so well. So anyway, all of that is to say, in summary, yes, it's a difficult time for the UN, but with leadership of the Secretary General and the goodwill of heads of state around the world, including President Bush, there is a real concerted effort to try to come to some decisions about, from a policy and governance level, what could change in order to improve the operation of the UN. And then from a structural level, what needs to be changed in order to improve the accountabilities and efficiencies.
Mm. Well, how of the criticism that has been made about how the United Nations is run, how much of that do you think is politically motivated? That is, it's not a criticism of how policies are carried out. It's a criticism of the policies themselves, coming from people who think that the policy should be something different.
I think there are a whole lot of motivations as to why people are making criticisms of the UN. There's always in the U.S. there's always been people who don't like the UN. You know, remember those signs that people put on the side of their barns, "U.S. get out of the UN." And there's always been some newsletters that are critical of the UN. That's always existed, and the disagreements over the war in Iraq in 2003, I think part of that resulted in more people taking a more critical look at the UN, particularly people who weren't disposed to being favorable to the UN to begin with.
We're coming down to about our last 5 minutes on the program, and again, our guest is Catherine Bertini, Undersecretary General for Management at the UN. She's here visiting the campus to talk about really a subject that has to do with the previous job that she had, that is as Executive Director of the UN World Food Program. We do have a caller here in Chicago to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Line number four. Hello.
Former Senator McGovern had been working on the food programs, I believe, with the Club of Rome and other agencies. I was wondering if they're working independently or are they converging in their efforts for heroes?
Wonderful that you asked. Former Senator, former Ambassador McGovern has been a real leader in promoting food for all, for education for all, for children around the world. And he, he's been working from the very beginning of this, his conceptual development of this idea. He's been working with the World Food Program, with the Food and Agriculture Organization, and with the UN. He's an ambassador for the UN, and he's and for the World Food Program. His ideas were encapsulated into our work, including into a big school feeding initiative undertaken by the World Food Program while I was still there that continues to this day. Also, there's a law now passed by Congress, the McGovern-Dole School Feeding Initiative, and this year it got a little bit more funding, which is good. This is another thing to write to members about if it's something you like, the McGovern-Dole School Feeding Initiative, because this is, of course, also Bob Dole, former senator. And I think they're paving the way for a lot more support in the future for programs to send food to schools to help recruit children to school and to help them have enough sustenance so that they can be able to absorb their education while they're there.
I was also going to ask about the matter of coordination. I know with the tsunami effort, coordination became a factor. Now we have other things that are arising in the world, like the flu epidemic wiping out flocks of millions of chickens and other livestock are occasionally affected, like the mad cow and other things. I was wondering if they're concentrating on any development of food substitutes that would be available in the event these other traditional supplies are no longer around. So I was wondering if there's any effort on concentrating developing food substitutes for those things. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I can't answer the caller on food substitutes. I don't know the extent of the work in that area, but there is a lot of work to identify great food shortages and then either to help support the local agriculture community to be able to meet those shortages or to bring in food where necessary.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We've here come to the end of the time. I do want to mention again for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Catherine Bertini, she'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum, 600 South Gregory in Urbana. This is a MillerCom event sponsored also by the folks in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. It's open to anybody who would be interested in attending. Our guest, Catherine Bertini, Undersecretary General for Management at the UN, former Executive Director of the UN World Food Program. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for having me.